The psalmist aptly described us men as fearfully, wonderfully made. We are many-sided creatures, complex, conflicted. We often show in swift alternation and sometimes in the same action, wisdom and folly, energy and lassitude, courage and timidity. I suppose the virtue of biography, of dwelling on the life of any man, is that it reminds us of the complexity of human nature. It reminds us that there are no unblemished saints, no all-wise scholars, that each of us is fallible, frail, and a creature of paradox. Yein adam asher lo yechata. There is no man so righteous that he sinneth not. Now, could we analyze the great figures of this century? I doubt that we would find one who had more sides to him, who was more complex and perhaps more conflicted than Lord Bertrand Russell, who died some 2 weeks ago at the ripe young age 97. Surely he was a man of many parts, philosopher, mathematician, logician, writer, pamphleteer, historian, essayist, professional lecturer, educational reformer, crusader in 100 causes, professional gadfly, raconteur, scholar, and above all, unique, himself a character. When he was a nonagenarian in his 90s, at a time when most other men who have somehow survived have retreated to their hearth and to their slippers, Lord Russell stayed in the vortex of the political arena. He tried to mediate between Premier Castro and the Russians and President Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He did encourage communication between Chou En-lai and Nehru and U Thant during the Indian-Chinese border war of 1961. And he published those letters and that correspondence. He published and edited 3 volumes of his autobiography. He participated in a goodly dozen of public demonstrations against atomic weapons testing and against nuclear war. He organized and conducted a mock war crimes trial in which the United States was put in the prisoner's dock symbolically for alleged atrocities in Vietnam. He appeared on 1,000 platforms arguing for a good dozen of causes dear to him. He had no day of retirement, simply being quiet and drawing in unto himself. Now this one-time wunderkind, this one-time child prodigy, was blessed, I presume, with an exceptional amount of sheer animal energy. The watch never seemed to run down. He could go long after all others had retired. And he was a man whose mind would never let loose of an idea, of an experience, till he had somehow ingested it and digested it and drawn from it what he could of understanding about man and about nature. He was blessed by the God in whom he never believed, and with an unusual mental apparatus, one which was capable of acumen and clarity, and also sometimes of remarkable folly. But the one redeeming virtue in all of this was that he was something more than a human brain. He had a capacity which is rare even among people who are not as cerebrally endowed. And that is, he could say 3 simple words which most of us find it most difficult to speak. He could say, I was mistaken. I was wrong. Late in his life, he said that about the bulk of his epistemology, the bulk of his scientific philosophy. He had worked for decades to produce this material, and it had been significant, as significant as any produced in our generation. But he was able to say, in this, and this, and this, I was wrong. And he was able to say this about his politics, about his economics. When most men, as they grow older, grow more rigid, Russell, interestingly, as he grew older, grew both more rigid and more flexible. About some things, he was blind. But about others, he was remarkably tolerant. In 1920, just after the Bolshevik Revolution, Mr. Russell published in The Liberator, a radical English monthly, which is actually American monthly, published an article in which he justified Lenin's thesis that revolutionary ends, urgently needed social and economic ends, could legitimately be achieved by means which were less than wholly noble. That one could ride roughshod over people's rights in order to achieve the economic utopia. And then that summer he went to the Soviet Union, and when he returned, he published in a less doctrinaire radical journal a recantation of all that he had said. He saw the suppression of the intellectuals. He saw the abuse of the kulaks. He saw tens of thousands of people being moved from their homes to the farms, from the farms to Siberia. And he had no patience with this kind of ruthless misuse of human beings. And he said in passing in this article a creed which I think all of us could hold dear and true, that tolerance and kindness are worth all the ideologies and the creeds of men. Kindness and tolerance are worth all the ideologies and creeds of men. It's a common phenomenon among young revolutionaries in every generation that they know what mankind needs. They're sure of it. But mankind is blind and obdurate and obstinate. And there are institutions which will not simply cave in because they wish it so. And so, as we've seen with many of the young radicals of our own generation, they become essentially fascist in their strategy. They say, it doesn't matter what we do in order to achieve utopia, the important thing is to get there. And in the process, they commit crimes, if they have power, at least as bad as the crimes that are being committed by those now in power. Now, Russell saw through very early in his political career this kind of cant. I remember reading in one volume of his this. He observed that many people, good people, are convinced that if they only had the power, then they could solve all the problems of men. Benevolent despotism has always appealed to the saint. The problem is, he said, that though the saint may become a despot, power can be drawn to oneself. The minute he does, he ceases to be a saint. His benevolence disappears. Because power inevitably is abused and misused. And ultimately, you cannot achieve even the most desirable ends by undesirable means because you simply add to the amount of misery and misfortune already in the world. Russell was one of those rare people who is bitterly and searingly critical of his own society, who sees all of its faults and mistakes, who understands exactly how special privilege operates to his own advantage, who would like to see the social and economic orders transformed, who is contemptuous of the self-righteousness of those in power, but who does not fall into the trap of assuming that as he paints in the blackest of colors the terms of his own society, as a counterpoint to that, he will paint some revolutionary society in the brightest of hues. It took the purges of Stalin, the doctor's trials, the 1930s, to convince most of those who shared the radical economic views of Lord Bertrand Russell to come to their senses about the real nature of the Soviet Union. It was simply another state which organized power according to its own insights. It was not the utopia. It was not the ultimate solution for all men. Lord Russell found this out in 1920. And throughout his life, however bitterly he criticized England, the West, the society of which he was a part, In most things, he was able to see the mote in the other government's eyes. He never made a fetish of other societies. And so he was always in that unique position of being abused by everyone. The West for his criticism, the East for his lack of adulation. He walked his own way, however, and he kept his own mind, and for that he won the respect of all men of intelligence and character. He had one other quality, this original man, this archetypical nonconformist, a quality which I would like to see more of in the young rebels who claim his mantle. He took his medicine. He spoke his piece, and he stood his ground. He didn't first present the school administration with a piece of paper which said, "I hereby guarantee that the following demonstrators will be granted amnesty if they demonstrate." He demonstrated, he decided what he believed in, and he went to jail for his beliefs. In the First World War, he spent 6 months in jail for his pacifism, for having opposed British entry into that war. At the age of 89, when most of us would like simply to be in the quiet of our homes, he accepted the quiet of a London jail for 7 days because he would not guarantee a British magistrate that he would be on his good behavior and not engage in any further anti-nuclear testing demonstrations. He lost a position at City College of New York when he was in very serious financial difficulty because he would not recant or retract social views, liberal social views about marriage and personal morality, which he had long since espoused. He was a man of decided opinion. And like all men of decided opinion, he liked to state it, and to state it again and again. And he also, like most men who have eccentric opinions, he liked to take the needle and to prick the pomposities of particularly the aristocracy into which he had been born. But one quickly discovered, as one read Russell, that for all the talent which he had in turning a good phrase, and one must remember that this philosopher won a Nobel Prize, not in philosophy, but in literature. For all his skill in turning a great phrase, Lord Russell always had a clear argument, a deep understanding of the issue on which he took a stand. And that, of course, made it very difficult to refute him. Indeed, such refutation as most of us would offer was simply in this, that he assumed that men could be governed by reason. He was enough a child of Greece to believe that somehow the reasonable man, having once made up his own mind, could control his destiny and could find by sheer logic, clear thinking, the way which would lead to happiness. And so we find in works such as Marriage and Morals and other books in which he discussed human nature and our human condition, books in which 50 years ago he espoused what is today called the new morality, sexual freedom, trial, marriage, companionate relationships of all kinds. We find that he argues in these books for a greater ambit of personal freedom, because obviously men who are reasonable should be able to undertake and enjoy that freedom and take advantage of it without trampling on the rights and freedoms of others. And what he fails to understand, and he fails in most of his books to understand, is this. That for all our capacities of reason, whatever our IQ, however high it be, we are still creatures, A, of habit, B, of community, and C, that there are within us roiling depths. Russell was a genius. Russell was a man of impeccable logic. He also was a man who went through 4 marriages and a number of well-publicized love affairs. He never, despite all his mental apparatus, was able to will to think himself into being a happy human being. Why? Because in fact, community makes us happy. We need to be able to touch others, to relate to them. Why? Because ultimately, happiness is something more than knowing that this and this and this will make us happy. You can't will yourself to be happy. It simply happens. And often we are happiest within rules. They are comforting. They are encouraging. They prevent us from living always on the edge of frustration, on the brink of disaster. And so for all of his logic, there's a peculiar blind spot in Bertrand Russell when it comes to depth psychology and to Mr. Freud, and particularly when it comes to the insights of modern sociology. Reason alone, he seems to prove by his life, despite the reasonableness of all that he writes, reason alone will not get us to the goal which he seeks. But I commend to you the writings of this man. If you ever want to read his library, take off about 10 years. He first published in 1896. He last published in 1969. Between those two dates, for 74 years, he was writing constantly. He published 65 books, of which at least three quarters are narrowly written, scholarly volumes of major worth. He published over 250 long critical essays and innumerable pamphlets and lectures and material of this kind. He was a literary avalanche. And if you tried to keep up with him, you inevitably were borne under the torrent of his writing. But what you read was worth reading. In first instance, because it was thoughtful. In the second instance, because it generally was delightful. Let me read you a paragraph just to give you a feeling of Lord Russell's writing. It's from a history book of all things. He wrote one of the greatest histories of the 19th century which has ever been penned. It's called Authority and Freedom. It was written in the early 1930s. And I cite this paragraph in part because it shows you some of his attitudes towards one of the issues so important in Jewish life, the attitude of the non-Jewish world to us. It comes in a chapter in which he's describing Karl Marx. Marx, he writes, was the first intellectually eminent economist to consider the facts of economics from the standpoint of the proletariat. The orthodox economists believed that they were creating an impersonal science as free from bias as mathematics. Marx, however, had no difficulty in proving that their capitalist bias led them into frequent errors and inconsistencies. The whole of economics, he maintained, took on a completely different aspect when viewed from the wage earner's point of view. His devotion to the interests of the proletariat is perhaps somewhat surprising in view of his bourgeois origin and his academic education. He had all his life a love of domination associated with a feeling of inferiority, which made him prickly with social superiors, ruthless with rivals, and kind to children. It was probably this trait in his character that first led him to become the champion of the oppressed. It is difficult to say what caused his feeling of inferiority, but perhaps it was connected with his being a Jew by race and a Christian by education. He may, in this account, have had to endure the contempt of schoolfellows in his early years without being able to fall back upon the inner self-assurance that would be possible to a Jew by religion. Anti-Semitism is an abomination, but it has had one incidental good effect, that it has raised up among Jews tribunes of the people who might otherwise have been supporters of the status quo. If this view is just, Marxism is a suitable punishment for the illiberality of well-to-do anti-Semites. Now, I submit to you, you have here a thumbnail, incisive biography of Marx, an understanding of his character, and a brilliantly turned phrase about anti-Semitism and the position of the Jew in the liberal movements of the 19th and 20th centuries. There's current among us a feeling that no professional man should live simply within the confines of his profession. And it's been particularly true about academics, about teachers and professors. We have a feeling, especially the young have the feeling, that all of these men should leave their studies and their classrooms and their research and embroil themselves in the politics of their day. They must be committed. There must be no ivory tower. And certainly beyond any Cambridge don of his day, Lord Russell was involved in each and every political activity for a century. Whether it was the Italian attack on Ethiopia, the Spanish Civil War, women suffragettes, free sexual union, educational reform, the nuclear bomb, whatever it is, you found Russell active, planning, doing, writing, preaching, and working. And yet I would point out to you something. The greatest of his works, the most seminal of his ideas, were published before and during the First World War, during the earliest part of his career, when his life was still largely within the confines of his university and of his study. Principia Mathematica, the principles of mathematics, and some of his epistemology was all produced during this period. The more he became an activist, the less he became one of the original minds of our century. And my problem is this. I agree that all men ought to be committed. I agree that all men ought to be activists, but I wonder how much important original philosophy was lost because Bertrand Russell lost himself in so many causes. Many others, men of less remarkable endowment, could have been the pamphleteer he was for Fabian socialism, or the protagonist that he was for peace in Vietnam. But we are endowed in any generation with a few dozen men of rare mental ability who have had the opportunity for an exceptional kind of early training. Russell never was abused by a classroom, by publics or private schools. He was taught by tutors. He traveled everywhere. He was force-fed as a student. We have very few of these people. And I keep wondering that if we take them out of the classroom, and set them on another career, besides the career which is intellectually theirs, how many ideas, how many bits of art, monumental pieces of art, will we lose in the process? For the average academic, certainly. We don't need endless papers on inconsequential scholarly research in another learned journal. But for these unique people, these rare birds, I keep wondering. Even as I do, I say to myself, you are saying something in which deep down you don't believe. But that again is the paradox of human nature. And finally, let me say this of Bertrand Russell. He was devoted, above all else, to the application of reason to human affairs. He had no patience with superstition. He had no patience with the argument that because we have done it always this way, it must be done hereafter in the same way. He was restless under all kinds of traditional arguments and with all kinds of established institutions. And yet I found, as I read his autobiography in the last few months, I found that it was not reason, it was not the logic of which he was a master, which led him to this kind of remarkable social sensitivity and involvement, but a profound personal experience, an emotional experience such as most of us at one time or another undertake. And I find it particularly paradoxic that here the greatest logician probably of our century is not led to being a socialist, is not led to being a political radical, is not led to his form of arguments about participatory democracy by reason alone, but by the heart rather than his head. Let me read you two paragraphs from his autobiography. They are remarkably different than anything else in his autobiography and remarkably personal and I think important. The background of this setting is simply this. For 10 years of his life, he cooperated with Alfred North Whitehead in writing what became the groundwork of all modern mathematical logic, Principia Mathematica. Whitehead was a man a generation his senior. He was married to a woman who was a lovely, gentle lady, but also sickly. And this is Russell describing a visit at the Whitehead home. When we came home, we found Mrs. Whitehead undergoing an unusually severe bout of pain. She seemed cut off from everyone and everything by walls of agony. And the sense of the solitude of each human soul suddenly overwhelmed me. Ever since my marriage, my emotional life had been calm and superficial. I had forgotten all the deeper issues and had been content with flippant cleverness. Suddenly, the ground seemed to give way beneath me. I found myself in quite another region. Within 5 minutes, I went through some such reflection as the following. The loneliness of the human soul is unendurable. Nothing can penetrate it except the highest intensity of the sort of love that religious teachers have preached. Whatever does not spring from this motive is harmful or at best useless. And it follows that war is wrong, that a public school education, by which he means a private school, an aristocratic education, is abominable, that the use of force is to be deprecated, and that in human relations one should penetrate to the core of loneliness in each person and speak to that. The Whitehead's youngest boy, aged 3, was in the room. I had previously taken no notice of him nor he of me. He had then to be prevented from troubling his mother in the middle of her paroxysms of pain. So I took his hand and led him away. He came willingly and felt at home with me, and from that day to his death in the war in 1918, we were close friends. At the end of those 5 minutes, I had become a completely different person. For a time, a sort of mystic illumination possessed me. I felt that I knew the inmost thoughts of everybody that I met in the street, and though this was no doubt a delusion, I did in actual fact find myself in far closer touch than previously with all of my friends and many of my acquaintances. Having been an imperialist, I became during those 5 minutes a pro-Boer and a pacifist. Having for years cared for only exactness and analysis, I found myself filled with semi-mystical feelings about beauty, with an intense interest in children, and with a desire almost as profound as that of the Buddha to find some philosophy which should make human life endurable. Here we have what? Moses before the burning bush, Elijah hearing the still small voice, David waking up in the middle of the night hearing the music of the Lord sounding in his ear. Here we have the moment that comes to every man who can find the moment of truth in human relationships, who suddenly pierces through the faces, the superficial, the trivial, the labels which we apply and by which we deny to ourselves the reality of the world in which he lives. A soul suddenly opened up to another human soul, to spirit, and to God. And so I submit it has always been, even with the greatest minds among us. There comes a moment in the quiet of the night, in the press of the crowd, in the agony of inner conflict, when suddenly we awaken to the heart which pulses in every man. A moment which, if taken and grasped and understood, can transform our lives and allow us to transcend the humdrum and the everyday. For all of his philosophy, Russell was changed as a man in these 5 minutes. But most of us have such an experience and quickly dismiss it from mind. It lasts with us a romantic moment. We spend a day, no more, being kind and being gentle. And we revert to type. The wise man truly is the man who understands the meaning of that moment and allows it, as Russell did, to transform every moment of his life. Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, saith the Lord. Amen.